Today, so the second John Beeshan Memorial Lecture at the Open University, which is going to be given by John Norton as his inaugural lecture. I'd like to extend a special welcome, of course, to members of John's family and to members of John Beeshan's family who are also here today. We're delighted to have you with us. John came to the OU over 30 years ago. He might not like me telling you that, but there it is. And he now holds the position of the Professor of Public Understanding of Technology. His explanation for the longevity of his stay at the OU is that he came here promising himself that he would leave if he ever got bored. And guess what? He never did. He's still here because he's never done the same thing twice, he tells us. Describing himself as a control engineer with a strong interest in systems analysis and computer networks, John has had a very productive career at the OU, developing courses which explore and explain the origins and uses of technology in our lives. One of his most recent contributions is Relevant Knowledge, an evolving program of user-friendly short courses about various aspects of technology at work, at leisure, and in society. In recognition of the excellent work carried out in John's department, it is currently ranked through the Teaching Quality Assessment Audits as the best general engineering department in the country. John has successfully combined a career as an engineer and a journalist for many years, writes a weekly column about the internet in the business section of The Observer. He has also recently written a book called A Brief History of the Future, The Origins of the Internet, which comprehensively and entertainingly describes the history and significance of the internet and celebrates the engineers and scientists who are instrumental in its genesis. More than that, however, the book also provides some interesting and very personal insights into John's lifelong fascination with communication, with, as he puts it, the ability to make links in other places, other cultures, and other worlds. Apart from his academic career at the OU and his journalistic career, John is a fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge, a non-executive chairman of RABI, a think tank set up by Radio Advertising Bureau to help the advertising and radio industries think through the implications of digital technology. He's a non-executive director of One World International, a website that brings together the latest news and views from over 1,600 organizations promoting human rights awareness and fighting poverty worldwide. He's a founding partner of Ellipsium, a Cambridge-based ideas factory, and Ndio, an international project set up to foster an approach to networked computing that is simple, affordable, open, less environmentally damaging, and less dependent on intensive technical support than current networking technology. Finally, on the occasion of the second John Beeshan Memorial Lecture, I would like to remind us all of Professor Beeshan's many legacies to the Open University. First, he established the Open University as a leading centre of applied systems development. Secondly, under his leadership, the OU produced a set of courses that have been enjoyed by tens of thousands of students. And finally, he recruited able, varied and innovative staff, John Norton being one of them. I'm quite sure that you, like me, are looking forward to Professor Norton's lecture entitled The Social Life of Networks. So without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to call on John Norton to deliver his inaugural lecture. John.
Thank you, Vice-Chancellor. I'm reminded of something that happened to an old friend of mine, Claude Coburn, who in the 1930s was in China covering a war and was reported to have been killed. And the Times, the newspaper for which he then worked, published a small, slight, but appreciative obituary. And when he finally got back to Shanghai and read it, he sent a cable to the Times saying, "Have read obituary, stop. Kindly adjust salary accordingly." This lecture series was created to honour John Beeshan, the founding professor of systems at the Open University and my first head of department. He was by turns and sometimes simultaneously a friend, a mentor, a scourge and an inspiration. From him I learned a great deal about innovation and subversion in organisations, especially in this one. and in his later career, long after he left the Open University and had been appointed to rescue a failing polytechnic from an inferno of ideological intolerance, I saw him display the kind of personal courage that's quite alien to most academics. Intellectuals are good at many things, but in general, moral fortitude isn't one of them. But then, John wasn't your average intellectual. He was ferociously bright and resourceful, but not what you'd call cultivated. Aristotle, Plato, and Spinoza had passed him by. He first trained as a metallurgist, and to his dying day displayed an intense interest in defective or careless welding. He then switched to psychology for reasons I've never understood. After a DPhil in applied psychology at Oxford, he made the transition into that strange oxymoronic subject, quotes, management science, unquotes, becoming a reader at Sussex University in the late 1960s. So he was therefore already on an interdisciplinary trajectory when he was appointed professor of systems here in 1970. From the moment of his arrival in the faculty, two of his most prominent characteristics became evident. The first was his profound belief that the wrong people were in charge of the faculty, of the university, of the country, and indeed of the world at large. This was partly a product of his ideological heritage. He had been in his youth a communist sympathiser, if not actually a party member. But it was also partly a product of his anarchic temperament. He was by nature a troublemaker in the best sense, although of course those set in authority above him might not always see it that way. No sooner had he arrived in the Faculty of Technology, for example, than he declared that the proposed pace of academic development envisaged by the Dean and other senior colleagues was far too leisurely. He blithely announced, without consulting anyone, that the systems group would produce four courses in its first 4 years, a productivity target roughly four times greater than wiser counsels had believed possible and never subsequently attained. He then recruited a team of young academics, of whom I was one, and delivered on that foolish promise. And of course, in some quarters, he was never forgiven for that, because nothing quite irritates academic colleagues as much as success. The first course we created was called Systems Behaviour. It was designed to give students an appreciation of the power of systemic insight by looking at a number of complex real-world systems. One of the case studies chosen for examination was the telephone network, and therein lies my first tale. Remember that the year is 1972. The British telephone network was a state monopoly run by a Stalinist outfit called Post Office Telecommunications, a division of the nationalised Post Office, which had been created from the old General Post Office in 1969. Let us call this sinister organisation POT, if only because it rhymes nicely with that odious Cambodian dictator. Later on, in 1981, POT metamorphosed into British Telecom, or BT, a state-owned corporation independent of the Post Office. Like most state corporations, POT was supply rather than demand-driven. It had customers, of course, but their needs were regarded as subservient to those of the system. They could not, for example, choose their own telephone handsets. Only those approved by Post Office Telecommunications could be connected to the system. And you couldn't purchase phones, you could only rent them from POT. White ones, I remember, cost more. If you wanted a new phone line, then you filled in a form and waited for the company until the company deigned to install it. It could take weeks, sometimes months, sometimes never. The same applied if you wanted a new extension in your house or a change to your PA Bay X, your company switchboard. You had to wait upon the Post Office's pleasure. This mindset of total control was hardwired into the organisation's corporate DNA, and it had sinister as well as comical aspects. For example, there was an intimate relationship between Post Office Telecommunications and the security services. Every employee had to sign the Official Secrets Act upon taking up employment. Why? Because when MI5 or MI6 or Special Branch wanted to tap someone's phone, it had to be done by a POT employee physically installing the tap. This, then, was the organisational context of the system that John Beeshan decided OU students should study. It would have been relatively easy to have constructed an official explanation of how the telephone network operated, possibly even with the assistance of its owner. But John had the profound insight that if you really want to understand a system, then you should look always for ways in which it can fail. And at that time, a group of technological anarchists called phone freaks, that's freaks with a PH, had begun to explore the weaknesses in the network. They discovered, for example, that using an oscillator to emit a tone of a particular frequency into a handset could give you access to all kinds of system management facilities. It could, for example, enable you to make international calls for free. These people were driving the telephone authorities wild, for good reasons and bad. and chief among them was a young technical journalist named Duncan Campbell. It'll not surprise you to learn, therefore, that when John Beeson went looking for a consultant to help with the creation of our course module about telephony, it was on Campbell that his gaze alighted. And you can imagine the response. Pott was first incredulous, then furious, then incandescent with corporate rage. Threatening noises were made to the university. Questions were raised about John's suitability for an academic post, about his judgment, about his ideological background and beliefs. But he, and I'm glad to say the university, stood firm. And the module, which was created in the end by Peter Sorkotsky, a colleague from the faculty's electronics group, proved popular and academically successful with students. But that wasn't the end of the story. At this point, the other side of John's character came into play. He was, as I've said, a metallurgist by background and intensely practical by nature. He was good with his hands and loved dismantling and repairing things. The systems group at that time was housed in a temporary building, now long demolished, and was growing like crazy as more academics and support staff were recruited. It wasn't long, therefore, before the original arrangement of phones and extensions became dysfunctional. We needed a new topology for our departmental phone system. Accordingly, a request was made to the telephone authorities for the necessary alterations, and back came the response, after the statutory interval, that its engineers would be available to do the work at their convenience. Needless to say, this infuriated John. So one weekend, he came in on Saturday and single-handedly rewired our phone system. Just like that. Now, knowing what you now know about post office telecommunications, you can imagine the outcome. Our departmental legend has it that when the company discovered the crime, it threatened to terminate telephone service not just to the technology faculty or to our department, but to the entire university. I don't know, and I never knew, how the matter was resolved in the end, but I have no doubt at all that it did little to enhance John's esteem in the eyes of the university's senior management. Now, these two stories about the consultancy offered to Duncan Campbell and the unauthorised rewiring of the systems group telephone extensions are interesting because they reveal something of the personality of the man we honour today. But as it happens, they also serve as a good jumping-off point for my main concern, which is the social dimension of communications networks. There was a time when the telephone network was probably the most complex machine that engineers had ever built. From our point of view, it had two important characteristics. The first is that every telephone network was tightly controlled. The second is that phone networks were optimized for a single function, that is to say, voice calls. Tight control was implemented in two main ways. Firstly, through ownership. Telephone networks were either the property of the state, as in Britain, or of a state-licensed monopoly, as in the US. And ownership brought with it draconian powers. It enabled the owner, for example, to determine who and what could connect to the network and on what terms, and what they could use the network for. The most comical illustration of this that I know of comes from the US, where the giant AT&T Corporation was the owner of the network. My friend Larry Lessig tells a story in his book, The Future of Ideas. What happened was this. In 1956, a small company in the US made a device called Hushaphone. The Hushaphone was a simple piece of plastic that attached to the mouthpiece of a telephone. It blocked noise in a room so that someone at the other end of the line could better hear what was being said. The device had no connection to the technology of the telephone. It had no electronics in it of any kind. All it did was block noise, much the way you might do by cupping your hand over the phone. When the Hushaphone was released on the market, AT&T objected. The device was, they said, a foreign attachment. Regulations forbade any foreign attachments without AT&T's permission. AT&T had not given Hushaphone any such permission. The Federal Communications Commission agreed with AT&T, and the Hushaphone was history. Now, of course, as Larry points out, Hushaphone is an extreme case. The real purpose of the foreign attachments rule was, at least as AT&T saw it, to protect the system from dirty technology. A bad telephone attached to the telephone system could, AT&T warned, bring down the system for a whole region. Telephones were lifelines. At the time, AT&T provided telephone connections for 85% of all US households, and they had to be protected from the experiments of an inquisitive nation. But you will get the point. The effect of tight ownership of the network was to restrict innovation to what the owner would tolerate. AT&T was able to dictate the pace of technological change. The second aspect of telephone networks was that they were designed for a particular application, the making of voice calls, and this determined their technology. It made them what we call circuit-switched systems. If I wanted to call my mother in Ireland, I first dialed into my local exchange, which then set up a link to a regional exchange, which then set up a link to an international switching centre, which then set up a link to its counterpart in Ireland, which then, well, you get the idea. Eventually, Ma's phone would ring, and when she picked it up, it was as if a continuous length of copper cable stretched from my handset in Cambridge to hers in County Mayo. But that was an illusion created by circuit switching. Circuit switching was fine for voice communication, but it was hopeless for linking computers. It was inherently slow. Think of all those switches which had to be thrown in sequence to make the connection. And as time and technology moved on, and the switches changed from being clumsy electromechanical devices to all electronic ones, the time needed to set up a call reduced. But it was still slow compared to the operating speeds of computers, even in 1965. Secondly, circuit switching was intrinsically uneconomic. Telephone plans, that's lines, exchanges, switches, and so on, cost money to install and maintain. It involves expensive assets which ought to be worked as hard as possible. But while Ma and I were talking, nobody else could use that line. And the circuit had to be maintained for the duration of the call, even if there happened to be long periods of silence during it. This might be appropriate sometimes for human conversation, where silences are often part of the interaction, as indeed they were with my mother and myself. But for data communications, it was idiotic, because transactions between computers are intrinsically bursty. They take place in intense short spurts, punctuated by much longer periods of inactivity. Consider, for example, the communications requirement of time-shared computing, then becoming common in 1972. And incidentally, it's worth remembering, by the way, that the OU was the first university in the world to offer time-shared access to undergraduates, and we were doing it in 1972. Other universities, like Cambridge, where I was before I came here, provided such access to graduate students, but I believe we were the first to give it to primary degree students. In a time-shared system, the user sat at a terminal connected via a circuit switch line to a host computer. For much of the time, she and the circuit, which, remember, is tied up by the connection, was inactive. She was thinking, perhaps, or hesitantly typing in best two-finger style. Then she hit the return key to send the line of text, and there was a frantic burst of data down the telephone line, followed again by absolute silence. The host machine absorbed what the user had typed and responded with another burst of characters, which appeared on her screen. Then the line went quiet again. So most of the time, that expensive telephone connection was doing precisely nothing. In fact, it was reckoned that in a typical interactive computer session, less than 1% of the available transmission capacity was ever being used. The point is a very simple one. A network that is optimized for one application may be absolutely useless for other newer applications, which is why the old-style telephone network was always doomed. But I'm running ahead of the story. In 1972, just around the time we were writing our course in systems behavior, a new communications network had come into being in the United States. It was called the ARPANET, and it was specifically designed to enable computers to communicate with one another. Its technology was radically different from that of the phone system. It was a packet switch network, in which small packets of data were moved between computers over a network of permanent connections. It was funded by Bob Taylor, who was then a senior official in the Department of Defense's Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, and with whom I later had the honor of co-authoring a paper on managing research teams. The ARPANET had been constructed in the teeth of opposition and the professional incredulity of AT&T. Despite this opposition, by the autumn of 1972, the new network was up and running smoothly. It clearly worked, despite AT&T's insistence that it couldn't. But the ARPANET was a military system with the kind of unitary architecture that you get when the prime contractor is the Pentagon. The question for ARPA was then, what next? Already by that time, several other experimental packet switch networks were up and running. There was one, for example, created by Donald Davies and his colleagues at the UK's National Physical Laboratory in Teddington. There was one in France, and another one operating wirelessly, called Aloha, at the University of Hawaii. So ARPA set up a new research project, which they called the Internetworking Project. Its objective was to create a network that would seamlessly mesh all these different networks into a global system. The Internetworking Project was led by a group of young postdocs and graduate students who had cut their teeth on the ARPANET. Chief among them were Vint Cerf, who is now Vice President of Google, and Robert Kahn, an exceptionally gifted engineer. The design problem that confronted these young men, and they were all males, I'm afraid, was as difficult to solve as it was easy to formulate. It was this. How do you design a communications network that is future-proof? Or more prosaically, how do you design a network for applications that nobody has yet dreamed of? The Serf Kahn solution was stupendously elegant and simple, and it was based on two axioms. First, you abandon entirely the idea of ownership or central control. There should be no gatekeeper, no AT&T or BT determining what the network could be used for or who would be able to access it. This you could call the permissiveness principle. Secondly, you do not optimize the network for any particular application. Instead, you make the network as simple and general as possible, and you leave all the ingenuity to the applications that people dream up for it. You assume, in other words, that your users are smart. This led to the idea of a network that simply did one thing. It took in data packets at one end and did its level best to deliver them to their destinations at the other end. The network wouldn't care what's in those packets or what they represented. If you could do it with packets, then the new internet work would do it for you. And this is what became known as the end-to-end principle. In the 10 years between 1973 and 1983, Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn and their colleagues articulated these principles and implemented them in software, in protocols and software. And on January the 1st, 1983, the new network, now called the Internet, was switched on. And at that moment, the world changed. Most of the technologies that have shaped our civilization have had their effects through unintended consequences or applications. The mechanical clock first made its appearance in Benedictine monasteries in the 12th and 13th centuries. The impetus behind the invention was, in Neil Postman's words, to provide a more or less precise regularity to the routines of the monasteries, which required, among other things, 7 periods of devotion during the course of the day. The bells of the monastery were to be rung to signal the canonical hours. The mechanical clock was the device that could provide precision to these rituals of devotion. But what the monks did not foresee, as Lewis Mumford pointed out later, is that the clock is a means not only of regulating periods of spiritual devotion, but also of regulating the actions of men. The mechanical clock, Mumford wrote, made possible the idea of regular production, regular working hours, and a standardized product. In short, without the clock, which was designed to facilitate the worship of God, capitalism, which after all is the worship of mammon, would have been impossible. The history of technology is full of stories like this. Thomas Edison was convinced that the phonograph would find its main use as a dictation machine for businessmen. Marconi regarded radio as a point-to-point technology. The inventors of the digital computer thought they were building a calculating machine, and so on. In each case, the inventor of the technology thinks he knows what his invention is for, but is wrong. In the end, it's always society that discovers what the killer application is. The internet is a really radical departure from this pattern, in that its inventors explicitly acknowledged from the outset that they had no idea what it would ultimately be used for. So what was a bug for most inventors was actually a feature for them. And what they invented was essentially a machine for springing surprises, or more prosaically, a system for enabling disruptive innovation. Because that was the logical consequence of their two design axioms. The first one about an ownerless permissive network. Secondly, a network that did only one thing, deliver data packets from one end to the other. What the design philosophy meant was that if you had a good idea for a product or a service, and if that product or service could be delivered by using data packets in the way specified by the network's protocols, then the internet would do it for you with no questions asked. There would be no gatekeepers telling you to keep out, and no moral policemen saying, "Oi, you can't use the network for that." The result was an explosion of creativity which shook and continues to shake the established order in business, in government, in security, in education, in almost everything else to its core. And it would take much more than a single lecture to chronicle the extent of this explosion, to traverse what Manuel Castells calls the Internet galaxy. So I'm going to focus today on just 3 examples which illustrate the profound consequences of the end-to-end architecture that Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn devised. The first of these surprises was the World Wide Web. Nobody knows how big the web is. When Google stopped boasting about the number of web pages that it indexed, the figure stood at just over 8 billion. At a conference in this theatre quite recently, the head of research at Yahoo talked about the web being 20 billion pages plus. There are serious people out there who reckon that this is just the tip of an iceberg, that the total size of the web may be 400 times the number of pages indexed by search engines. If that's true, then we're looking at a web that already contains more than 3 billion pages. Some research in Berkeley in 2000, which is now a long time ago, estimated that 7.3 million new web pages are created every day. That's over 5,000 a minute, and that was back in 2000. The web is an unimaginable transformation of our communications environment. Imagine now what life would be without it. And it has come into being in just over a decade and a half. The most significant thing about it, though, is not really its scale, but the fact that it was effectively the creation of a single individual, the British physicist Tim Berners-Lee. In the late 1980s, Tim, whom I had the honour to present for an honorary degree in this theatre in 2001, was working at CERN, the European Particle Physics Lab in Geneva, as a huge research facility with a large shifting population of visiting scientists from all over the world. CERN suffered from terrible collective memory problems. Documents were always getting mislaid, research results were held on experimenters' computers all over the world, and it seemed impossible to conceive of a filing system that could hold all the data generated by the particle accelerator and by the physicists who used it for experiments. So Berners-Lee sat down and worked out a scheme for a global hypertext system that would enable information and data resources to be stored and retrieved from all over the net. He called it the World Wide Web. In a single annus mirabilis, working with a very small group of colleagues, Tim designed the protocols and wrote the server and browser software needed to implement his idea. And then in January 1991, he released it on the net. The rest, as they say, is history. But note this. Berners-Lee consulted nobody about any of this, except his managers at CERN, who gave him the permission to spend his time working on the project. When the software was finished, he did not have to seek the permission of anyone to launch the web. He simply put the software and the protocols on the net, and the network did the rest. In doing so, this modest, self-effacing British physicist changed our world. And what enabled him to do it was the end-to-end principle embedded in the network's DNA. Tim conceived the web in 1989. 10 years later, in the United States, a disaffected, music-obsessed teenager named Sean Fanning was wondering how to find and share music on the net. People forget nowadays that there were always music files on the net. But in 1989, a German company, Fraunhofer Gesellschaft, obtained a patent for a method of compressing audio files which reduced their size without noticeably degrading the sound quality. The official name for this technique was MPEG Audio Layer 3, but it rapidly became known as MP3, and it had the effect of making it easier to transfer audio files simply because it made them much smaller. So the arrival of MP3 encoding led to an explosion of music files stored on hard drives on both personal computers and internet servers. The problem was, how could a music lover find the files? And once you'd found them, how could you obtain a copy? This is what was bugging Fanning. So he sat down and wrote some software that solved both problems. His solution came in a two-part package, a small downloadable client program that would run on people's PCs, and a server program that would act as a kind of constantly updated dating bureau, which put PCs seeking a particular track directly in touch with PCs whose owners had that track and were prepared to share it. Fanning called his system Napster, and in 1999 released it onto the net. I don't need to tell you what happened next. Napster went from 0 to 80 million users in the 18 months it took the record industry to get it shut down. But by the time it finally closed, the genie was out of the bottle. Teenagers all over the world had got the file-sharing habit, and they haven't lost it. Today, more music files are being illicitly shared over the net than were ever exchanged in the heyday of the original Napster. And of course, in a way, everybody knows this story. But strangely enough, I don't think we have fully absorbed its lessons. It provides, for example, another vivid demonstration of the power of the end-to-end principle. Sean Fanning had an idea that could be realized using data packets. So he wrote the software, and the net did the rest. The file-sharing phenomenon is a vivid illustration of the capacity of the net to spring surprises. In this case, the surprised party was the record industry, which ought to have recognized the internet as a heaven-sent technology for distributing its product, but didn't. By the time it woke up, the game was over. Despite all the legal huffing and puffing of the industry and its expensive lawyers, the die is cast. From now on, all recorded music will be online, period. The only question is, what percentage of it will be paid for? More than that, what Napster showed was that music need never go out of print, as it were. Up to 1999, only a tiny fraction of all the music ever recorded was obtainable for purchase. When the stock of recordings of a particular album was sold out, then the music was effectively unobtainable by legal means, unless the publisher decided to reissue it. But Napster showed that every recording ever made could be available 24/7, 365, which is why the service was correctly dubbed the Celestial Jukebox. For me, though, the most interesting aspect of the Napster story is what it tells us about innovation and the Internet's role in it. It turns out that what Sean Fanning invented was something far bigger than a device for ripping off record companies. It was, in essence, an innovative way of harnessing what Clay Shirky calls the dark matter of the Internet, those millions and millions of hitherto useless PCs connected to the net. The technology was later dignified with the name peer-to-peer networking, and it has evolved to become one of the most important communications technologies that we have. It is, for example, the technology which underpins the wildly successful Skype internet telephone service, which is currently growing at the rate of 150,000 new subscribers a day. Peer-to-peer networking is the technology by which the Hollywood studios will eventually use to distribute their movies online. And yet, if you were to listen to the clamour of the record companies and their media megaphones, you'd think that PDP was the spawn of the devil, rather than an increasingly important part of our network future. I want to turn now, finally, to the third great surprise that the Internet has sprung on us, the spread of open-source software, and in particular the Linux operating system. The term open-source is actually a business-friendly euphemism for free software. It was coined, I think, because programmers in the US felt that anything with the word free software on it smacked of communism, and that they thought was not a good idea in the United States. The idea that software should be free is actually a very old one. It originated in the 1980s with Richard Stallman, a famous MIT researcher. And what he meant by it was not that software should cost nothing. After all, Internet Explorer, for example, is free. It costs nothing. But that users should have the freedom to modify the code to suit their own circumstances. Quotes, free as in free speech, not as in free beer, unquote, is how Stallman explains it. The French would say software libre, not software gratis. But whoever the principle is expressed, at its heart, is the freedom to tinker. Stallman's great idea was to devise a licensing system that would enable programmers not only to write and distribute free software, but also to ensure that the software thus created would remain free. He came up with a special license called the GPL, which stands for the GNU General Public License, which uses copyright law to ensure that anyone who takes advantage of the freedom to tinker in order to create new software has to pass on the same freedoms to any subsequent user of what they create. In an Eton version, Stallman christened this ingenious application of copyright law, copyleft. I think that the GPL will turn out to have been one of the seminal innovations of the 20th century. It has enabled programmers to create, to share, to improve and maintain much of the technical infrastructure that underpins the modern world. The Internet runs on free software, for example. Most web pages are served by free software. Most email travels courtesy of free software. And most importantly of all, Linux is free software. The origins of Linux are as striking as the origins of the web. Once again, it goes back to a single individual. In this case, a Finnish graduate student named Linus Torvalds, who bought a PC in 1991 and didn't want to run the Microsoft operating system on it. So he took and modified a toy operating system called Minix, which had been created for teaching purposes by Andrew Tannenbaum at the Free University of Amsterdam and released under a free software license. Torvalds then released his toy operating system onto the net and invited people to critique and improve it. Using the free software tools developed by Stallman and his colleagues at MIT, other programmers did just that, and Linux evolved out of the collaborative efforts of first dozens and later hundreds of programmers into the sophisticated operating system that it is today. Now, if you're not a programmer, the significance of this may have escaped you. A modern operating system like Linux or Microsoft's forthcoming new version of Windows, Vista, is an unimaginably complex object. Vista, for example, has 50 million lines of code and more than 50 layers of interdependency. In terms of numbers of components and the density of the interactions between them, Linux and Vista are far more complex than a jumbo jet or an Airbus. But But Linux has been created by, yet Linux has been created by a community of developers who rarely, if ever, meet face-to-face and who work for free. And they have produced something that is remarkably robust and stable. For example, I gave up using Windows-based computers in 1999 because of the fragility of the software. I found that every machine I owned gradually degraded, was plagued by viruses, and wound up having to reboot my computer several times a day. In contrast, the servers which host the various websites for which I am responsible in one way or another all run on Linux. I can't remember when we last had to reboot any of them. Some have been running continuously for over 200 days. So it's not surprising to find that Google runs on Linux. So does Amazon. So does most of the stuff that NASA runs. If you have to bet your life or your business on the stability of an operating system, then Linux is what you choose. And yet this extraordinary artifact has been produced by a group of people linked only by commitment, technical virtuosity, and a communications network which enables them to collaborate. In that sense, Linux is the best example we have to date of what Manuel Castells calls the networked enterprise. And this in turn has a further significance. Remember what I said about the complexity of a modern operating system. For the last few years, we have watched Microsoft, the richest, most talented, most determined company in the computer business, and according to the Financial Times, the third most valuable company in the entire world, grappling with the gargantuan task of creating Vista, the latest incarnation of Windows. The checkered history of Vista is a story, essentially, of a great corporation buckling under the strain. When it finally ships early next year, sometime, Vista will be years behind schedule, and in its early releases, at least, will be only a pale shadow of what was once envisaged. The corporate trauma wrought within Microsoft by the struggle to bring Vista to market prompts a sobering thought. Will there ever be another major upgrade of Windows? Is the task of creating such a code monster now beyond the reach of even the most able and the wealthiest corporation in the world? Have we reached the point where we have to concede that huge software systems can no longer be built in the traditional monolithic manner, that we need to do these things another way? And might the process that produced Linux be that other way? Curiosity about the effectiveness of the open source production model is what led a colleague of mine, the Berkeley political scientist Steve Weber, to embark on the first sustained study of how the Linux model works. His conclusion is that the most significant thing about open source is not the software it produces, but the method it has invented for making unimaginably complex things. Steve Weber sees an analogy in the Toyota lean production system of automobile production, as revealed in a celebrated 1980s MIT study. The Japanese company invented a way of making cars that was radically different from how they were made by Western manufacturers. In the end, these manufacturers faced a stark choice. Make cars the Toyota way or go out of business. Now, all cars are made using the Toyota approach. The MIT study, writes Weber, made two simple and profound points. The Toyota system was not a car, and it was not uniquely Japanese. By the same token, he continues, open source is not a piece of software, and it is not unique to a group of hackers. John Beeshan recruited me to work here at the Open University in 1972. By coincidence, that was also the year when I began to write for The Observer, the newspaper for which I have written regularly ever since. So I've been an academic and a journalist all my working life. Conor Cruz O'Brien, my famous fellow countryman, was similarly afflicted. In fact, he once said, apropos his dual career, that he had a foot in both graves. In recent years, I've been The Observer's internet specialist. Within the office in London, my weekly column has been assigned an interesting name. On Friday mornings, the editor of the business section of the paper can be heard shouting, "Where the hell is Norton's rant?" Except that he doesn't use the word hell. And of course, I suppose I should be annoyed by this, but actually, secretly, I'm rather pleased, because it carries the implication that I feel strongly about this subject. And I do. In fact, I devoted a year of my life to writing a book about the origins and significance of the internet, because I felt strongly about the way influential people in our society were belittling a development that I regarded as being as liberating as the printing press had been four centuries earlier. I still remember the day I started on the book. It was after a lunch with the editor of a prominent British newspaper. I won't say which one because it would embarrass the said gentleman, but it wasn't the Guardian or the Observer. And he had said at one point in the lunch, with that sneering tone that the English ruling class traditionally reserves for engineering, about this internet thingy, now boy, isn't it just the citizen band radio de nos jours? It was an intensely irritating remark at the time, of course. But it had a salutary effect because it forced me to ask what's really significant about the net. And that led me to some of the insights that I've been trying to share with you this afternoon. The more I thought about it, the more I contemplated the implications of the architecture that Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn conceived, the more I began to realise how radical a technology this was. And what made it radical was essentially very simple. Cerf and Kahn had designed not a network of computers, not even a network of computer networks, which is the official definition of the network, but a system for connecting minds and enabling them to innovate, to communicate, and to collaborate without dictating the terms under which they could do so. In other words, it's the people who use it that make the network so powerful, not the technology itself. It's kind of obvious, really, but then, as many of you know, I'm very slow on the uptake. The funny thing is that when that penny finally dropped, what came into my mind was nothing to do with technology at all, but some lines from T.S. Eliot's poem, Little Gidding. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. And if you have been, thank you for listening.
Well, I'd like to start by extending a very warm welcome to all of our visitors, family members, Norton and Bation, all of whom are attending what is really for us, I think, a big celebration for the Faculty of Technology. Now, John's a hard act to follow, so I had to do some preparation for this little talk. So what do? I go on to Google. The most obvious and appropriate way. I got off to a bad start because I typed in John Norton and pressed return, whereupon I got 1.5 million hits. I then realized my mistake and typed in John Norton exact phrase and whittled it down to 150,000 hits. Now, to put this into perspective, if you type in Mike Mead, my name, into Google, and there's a name for this, I can't remember what it is, but when you type your own name into Google to see what comes out, I got 825 against mine, against 150,000 for John. Now, this doesn't really get us very far, because, you know, what is the quality of these hits? And we're forever telling our students that the next step is to refine your search. You've got to get those essential key phrases that help pin down the objective. So where do you start? We'll put in John Norton exact phrase plus academic, journalist, writer, blogger, guru, mentor, educational, pioneer, rule breaker. Or here's one for internal consumption, the man who wouldn't take no for an answer, beating against the university closed door, as it was at the time, in order to bring computing, home computing as we know it now, to all of our students, to bring it right into the mainstream. So of course, John is all of these things, and a difficult man to pin down. So I think if we can't pin him down exactly by choosing these key phrases, we might just ask, how does John describe himself? And this is a little bit easier because people who are awarded personal chairs are free to choose their own titles. We've seen a lot of this over the years, and it's actually very revealing sometimes to see just how people locate themselves on the spectrum of professorial titles. They go from the very precise but totally obscure, right away through to the grandiose, and very often chosen so that people are pinned down very, very securely into their own local academic community with titles to demonstrate how exclusive that community is and that it really is only for us who belong and not for those who are excluded. Now, in John's case, his title couldn't be more straightforward. And I was delighted when I saw it. He wants to be known as Professor for the Public Understanding of Technology. And there are a number of good reasons why this is a very good choice. First of all, in my view, it precisely sums up the person and his achievements. And we must recall that his talk here has been very much about the world outside, and notably, not very much about himself. Secondly, from a collegial point of view, I do feel that it's a title that captures the spirit of what we in the technology faculty aspire to. It's what we all want to do. We all want to promote public understanding of technology. And then finally, this is an occasion in memory of John Beeshan. I didn't know John. He actually sat on my appointment panel. I applied twice to come here. The first time I didn't get in, and I went home shaking from having been interviewed by John Beeshan. Came back 6 months later when they wanted more staff, and to my dismay found John Beeshan was again on the interview panel asking the same questions as I couldn't answer the previous time. So I had a quite slight acquaintance with him, but from what I've heard and from what I do know, the title that John has chosen, Professor for Public Understanding of Technology, is one that John Beeshan himself would have recognised and applauded. So thank you, John. It's been a very interesting afternoon.